Many people have asked to discuss or talk about or ask questions about the particular figures within the ring. We should talk about them. We can't leave them entirely. They might not be the most interesting part. There's much greater to come, but we'll have to do without that. So, let us look at the figures now. Let me see how this thing is very tricky. You're supposed to turn it down, isn't it? Now look. Now it's working. There we are. Here's our familiar facsimile number 2. Now I have a trusty beam here. That's right, the radio. Yes. We've talked about figures. Yes, we don't need that one. We've talked about figures 1 and 2 quite a bit, but there's more to be said about them we should notice here, things that Joseph Smith said about them. Notice it's badly damaged. We'll notice this thing is badly damaged. Not there, you don't see it. We'll see the overlays and so forth. But there must be more to it than that. The studied absurdity of figure 1 looks like nothing you ever saw. Well, that guarantees that nobody ever thought of it as real. With its 4 ram's heads on one neck, some of the hypercephali have 2 ram's heads, some have 4. This should have had 4. But all this has been wiped out, you see, at some time after Hedlock saw it, though. With his 4 ram's heads on one neck and the double human body, he sits on the ground holding the scepter of power. It is Ammon, originally. Now this is what Bonnet calls him in dictionary, he is a kultlose kosmische Macht, a cosmic power without cultic identity, a pure abstraction and nothing else. Don't look for pictures of anything here, they're not that. If you're going to accept it as an abstraction, we notice the great freedom with which the Egyptians can use these, with the understanding, as any good mathematician would say, this equals so and so. If we agree on what it equals, then we can use it in any operation, but we must agree on what it stands for. If you agree and know what this is, then it stands for, it is the pure idea of cosmic power, energy, see? Basic here. Exactly like Janus, we saw the same thing about Janus. And like Janus, he hides his real self here. It often says about him on the hypercephalus that he's hiding his real nature from his children. But he is, as such, he's invisible. His name Ammon, Yemen really means the hidden one. When you don't really know, you can't get to see him the last of all. The viewless winds, as Seta, the great Kurt Seta gives it, he's Yemen, the viewless winds that give breath and life to all things. He's the abiding one who is in all things, men, his name Ammon, men means to abide in, it's discussed also by Seta. Naturally, the Christian fathers saw the resemblance to their God in Ammon, the 4 goat-headed one. And we use the word too. Well, as Min was before all else a procreative one, naturally identified from the earliest times with the he-goat and the ram known for their zeal in reproduction. You notice everybody has ram's horns here, and he has the curly ones with it. They came later. But they must have the ram's horns, we've seen that. And he's identified from the earliest times with the he-goat, known for, I say, his zeal in reproduction, as the ram of Mendes, with which he's identified as early as the pyramid text. The Greeks identified him with Pan, but Ammon for them was simply Zeus, the supreme god, too. The Greeks also saw this as the supreme god. As king of the gods, he absorbed his competitor Amun-Re, as the great begetter, primal king, and so on. He was also the creator, we saw this also true of Janus, you know, and as such joins forces with Khnum, the great hymn to Khnum, and to Ptah, with whom he shares the types of the ram's horns. Now I'm going to skip liberally here. He compares some 16 drawings, now say it again, compares some 16 drawings, showing the course of the sun in the setting of heaven, earth, and underworld, and observes that there are various types of a common basic composition, on the coming forth of the sun, though that each one is the sun in a particular aspect. See. He compares some of them, the earth and the underworld, and though every example on the chart is different from the others, he says, the common elements show us where we are as the artists seek a well-thought-out relationship. He says, relationship is the whole purpose of these drawings, to show how things are related. Relationship between the figures. He warns against any nitpicking in circumstances, as well as we need to recognize that there are things, quoting him, which are opposed to our knowledge of reality as being incorrect and impossible. That's a lesson being driven home today as never before. Well, all of this applies to the study of the hypocephaloi. The most absorbing of the drawings of the study by Satha, the famous lifting up of the sunship from the coffin of Satyrs II, shows the earth floating as a disk in noon, completely surrounded by water. And we think, well, I'm going to do some heavy skipping here. And yet, got to get some pictures in here. These show the following. Yes, he says, what this represents, he does say this, we should consider this, he says. The most absorbing thing about these studies is that we see the earth floating in space. We think of it at once, the rim of the hypocephalus as the shield. It is, he explains, an attempt at a flat projection in the manner of our modern geographic maps. This is supposed to be a sphere. It's a cosmic pattern. It's holistic and supposed to show everything. It also depicts one part of the circle upside down with relation to the other, he says, as if they were the antipodes, or more correctly, anticephalium, the Janus heads, the reversed heads of our world. So we have the poles. They represent the different, that's upside down because of the polar idea, too. See why it's divided where it is later. But he departs in one thing from the conventional interpretation. We do not here have an unbroken cycle. This is the thing, as everybody has thought. Heinrich Schaefer and others emphasized that. It's a one-way course and one great episode of sunrise and rebirth. The charts show not the beginnings and endings of the heavenly cycles. There's not any autos. You end up where you started at all. But only the beginnings. The things really are timeless, showing only a representation of the positions of different parts of the universe relative to each other, exactly in the manner of a cartographic image, he says. It is all a hologram in which time is a matter of indifference, a timeless cosmos in which all things are present. And yet, the ever contemporary universe is divided into sections. You see now, we often find three main levels. Is this a safe thing to do? I'm going to press this button now. Next one. Well, this is the idea. This is the great hymn of Mendes, you see. There he is. There goes below it. And worshiped by the apes. You notice this is the same figure we have in the center of the hypocephalus. He's inside the solar disk there with the upraised arms of the ka, being praised by eight apes here. Usually it's eight apes, a pair of them. And by Thoth, who's keeping record of all things, and by interesting combination of the lotus, which is creation and rebirth, and the two feathers of Ammon of dominion. And yes, let's remove that. We'll go on to the next, maybe. Yes, here's another. Well, you'll see there are four apes. And ours are just two, but there's sometimes two, sometimes four, sometimes six, sometimes eight. Thereon hangs the tail. But the three main levels, here's an example. You see the three main levels. There's, would you believe it? There we go. One, two, three. Ain't education grand. This is the common pattern, the three levels. We've seen that all the time, the three worlds when the persons go into the, go on their ascensions, their mystic ascensions. They have to go through the three worlds. And you know, we're Middengird in Old English, mid-world, the mid-earth. And there's the lower world, and then the upper world, and we're the middle world. This is a basic pattern, universal pattern. It's between the sunrise and sunset that we see the sun at its zenith, sending down rays upon the earth in its fullest strength, and that's the one in the center. This represents the zenith. This represents, you see, noonday. This represents noon and solstice. The highest point the sun reaches starts going down. I mentioned that before. Notice he's on the go here. This one is backwards. He's supposed to be going to the right. Doesn't make much difference, though. and as it says here, that he is Ray. But I want you to notice the things on his shoulder too, because we refer to them a little later. What are they? What kind of creatures are they? They look like jackals here as far as that goes. We refer to them later. We notice also that on almost all, the two feathers on the top go through the top. They deliberately make him go through the top. He's not to be confined by this universe. But notice here, here are the eight rams. This is a ram, but they don't have room to draw eight of them, so they just put eight strokes. And he praises. So we have another boat here. But the divisions go this way. This is the sun at his zenith. In just such a manner, the hypocephali are divided. Figure 2 is the bright morning sun leaving one realm to go to another. See, he's going in both directions. He's just left behind and he's going ahead. This is the morning. It tells us that. I know I have known, you know, the past and the future here. So, we mentioned this before. While the reverse portion of the figure is the dark underworld, where he is to effect resurrection. You go down here, and of course this is where all the resurrection works go on here. Now, see something we may not have to skip. Back to Satan's point is that it makes no difference which zenith we refer to, since all happens with reference to one event only, its resurrection and rebirth. We've seen many times death and passing away, that's just part of the resurrection. That's a necessary episode in it. And it's not an opposition at all that they're trying to overcome. Ammon, seated within the shining disk, is always exactly in the center of the sky, quote, the highest point of the cosmic edifice, the middle and top of everything, which is at these charts trying to express in the matter of geographic maps. He calls it the Janus tier. He calls him the Janus figure because the faces, that Janus quadratus, you see, quadrifrons, and this is Janus bifrons, the two faces. But they're both Janus, dividing it right down the center. Don't want to review too much here. But he says that represents yesterday and tomorrow of the official Bürgerliche day. It represents the place of passage, the eternal now. The passage, the moment at which past goes into future, present. The present is just down here, goes down the center. When past goes into future, and that's the eternal now. As to number one, its foreheads are identified in the famous Mendes Stela, where the king is hailed as the friend of the great god Mendes, the one we just saw with all those immodest monkeys. The life of Ray, the male potency of the gods and mankind who appear in the region of light, I'm quoting from the Mendes Stela. We don't have time to read these things there anymore. As the four-headed one, illuminating the earth with his rays, who comes as the this is a point to make too. Anybody can make a good guess as to what these mean, and sometimes you could be right. It's a good clean fun guessing what this symbolizes, you see. But it's good to get an Egyptian statement on it, as many as you can get, saying that that's what they thought about it. Because Abraham, remember, tells his children, this is the way the Egyptians thought of it. It's not his religion. This is what the Egyptians taught, he says. So we're talking about that. So we should confirm everything here, we say, by a statement, and the Mendes Stela is a good example to tell us what this is supposed to be. Who appears in the reign of light, Achet, as the four-headed one illuminating the earth with his rays, who comes as the Nile to nourish the land, the breath of air to all mankind, hailed by the gods and goddesses in his form of the living ram, primal power, first of the gods, behold the divine benefactor in the image of Mendes, he's talking about Pharaoh there, the living copy of the God within the light, the divine issue of the Ram, eldest son of the Creator of all, who sits on the throne of the first of the gods, the prince in the womb, the ruler at the breast, that's when he's being brought up, whom the potency of the Father, the Ram of Mendes, has made strong, king, victorious, etc. Well, you get the idea. That covers about everything. And yet, the source of all this light is preeminently the hidden one. He's the invisible one, whose residence can never be known, we're told. On the hypocephali, remember, we're told that this is near the residence of God, but it isn't the residence. On the hypocephali, he who makes possible all life forms, we're quoting again, it says on the hypocephali itself, you see, makes possible all life forms, even while he hides himself from his children. The famous Leiden hymn to Ammon ends with a threat of death to anyone who would mention the real name of Ammon. As Amun-Re, he says, I have many names and many forms. My form is every god, the creator, king, all who possess many names whom the gods of heaven do not know. Isis desired to know my name. Well, now, we should be interesting how Joseph Smith figures this out. With the salient attributes of Amun, to be sure, he describes this figure one as first in creation, first in government. Of course, one might say that's perfectly natural, being the dominant figure in the circle. Remember, C.J. Jung sees in figures in the center of his circles the representation of the self in its relationship to the universe. And of course, the purpose of this is to relate the universe to yourself. Remember, these were private possessions belonging to individuals. Each one had his own. They were priests, people of very high. They were kept very secret in just a few families, which are not Egyptian, incidentally. They were very secret and passed on the tradition here. But each one had his primal image, the supremacy to primitive and children alike. Jung says everybody has his own private circle. These people did too. True, Joseph Smith doesn't call the figure God, but then it's not supposed to represent God, but rather a mysterious source of power nearest to the throne of God, he says. This one is highly visible to men, but God himself is withdrawn. You never see him. It's interesting that Mormons actually did use the name of Amun, as we mentioned before, to designate God in the Doctrine and Covenants, for example, 78 section 20, 95, 17, some of the hymns. So far, that could all be coincidence. Therefore, what concerns us, how Smith or Abraham looks at the whole picture, we can grasp if we best underline the nouns and verbs, as what I've done, in the official explanation. You have it with you. We should have put it on the board so we could all read it together, but I'm sure you have your pearls of great price here. But there we are. But what I've done is break down all the verbs and the nouns. They're mostly nouns and a few verbs. They're all very pregnant here. Yes, an official explanation. This should tell us what it's all about if we line all the verbs and nouns up. It once becomes apparent that there is nothing the least bit mystical or magical about the thing. The interpretation is intellectual and factual with a main emphasis on the following themes. Entirely in the Egyptian way, not mystical at all. First, the theme is cosmology. The words are used are earth, planets, firmament, sun, stars, moon, revolution. All those terms are used in this explanation of the hypocephalus. And you see, this is cosmological, very obviously. The next is measurement and number, which everything is basic. Measurement of time, celestial time, day, cubit, years, 1,000, quarters, numbers, due time, revolution, equal width. You're matching things up numerically too, relative to each other and so forth. And then, the idea of transmission of power or energy. This is receiving light, borrows its light, governs planets or stars, receives its power, the governing power. So there's control and influence. See, we got gravitation, we got something going on here, all sorts of forces. And it just describes their actions. It doesn't tell us what they are any more than we know what the forces are today. Then there's a hierarchy of dominion. Hierarchy is very important here because this is that Janus principle, you know, the opposite, but it's a level. Things happen at level and they go on up and down. And so we get creation, residence, got nearer to the residence, you see, government, key, power, God, throne, authority, all these things have to do with dominion at various levels, you see, being ruled and ruling. Authority, crown, light, holding the key, sitting clothed in glory, and governing. Then the idea of ordinances and procedures by which we make tangible connections with each other, relating the above to humanity especially. Key words, sacrifice, that's our whole business, is to connect human beings by sacrifice. Holy Ghost, Abraham, Dove, Temple of God, Egypt, all these things are tangible places where humans operate, function in this regard. And then the special idiom or notation, these are the verbs that are used. These verbal expressions, they indicate that we're using a special notation here, and these aren't pictures at all. So, the figures are not pictures, we're told, but symbols. They, quote, these are the verbs used. They represent, signify, pertaining to, answering to, called by the Egyptians, said by the Egyptians, will be given, not to be revealed, to be had in the temple, given to Abraham as he offered sacrifice. If the world can find out these numbers, so be it. So this is it. You see the various levels on which this is happening, how this has been delivered. But you get a very, begin to get a very clear picture of the type of thing that Joseph is supposed to be giving us here in this remarkable hologram. If we compare a score of the more imposing hypocephali, it will become at once apparent the same figures are found in the same relative positions, though of course some exemplars have fewer figures than others. Thus the worshipping apes that flank the central figures that we just saw, sometimes two in number, sometimes four, sometimes six or eight, but they always have the same significance. This principle clearly indicates the message of the hypocephali is to be taken as a whole. It's all a one story, not just a jumble, as Professor Wilson said, just a jumble of disconnected symbols that have nothing to do with each other. Just some Egyptian wrote down all these charms and talismans. He didn't know about the other hypocephali. When you have 100 of them following the same pattern, you know they're not random. But the more one considers, the more apparent it becomes that the purpose of the hypocephali is to draw things together, to present the principal powers and regions of the cosmos in a single plan. If, quote, the Egyptian of the 3rd millennium B.C., way back there, were very much aware of the fact that no symbol can possibly encompass the whole reality, it was because they'd been trying to do just that. They had a game. How much can you encompass in one symbol? Well, Indians play the same thing. We all like to do that. How many things does the cross signify and so forth? How many things does the caduceus signify? Kappert tells that countless drawings proclaim the effort to synthesize as much as possible. One might consider the hypocephalus an ultimate achievement in this regard, gets as much in as he can. When Count von Bissing pontifically announces that Joseph Smith has misrepresented the signification of every one figure, in facsimile 2, he proceeded to point out how wrong he was. He said, well, this is just Hathor, and figure 6 are the four children of Horus, and figure 4 is the god Sokar. Yes. As if the names Hathor, Horus, and Sokar explain everything before we have the vaguest idea what those names signify. They're symbols, as far as that goes. You haven't said a thing when you've used those terms because you got them from the Greeks anyway. Well, that's the question the books have been written about, and every one of them, the signification of which is still open to fruitful interpretation. How does that leave it up in the air? Well, no, we're going to quit that. Figure 1 is supposed to combine in one person the highest symbols of divinity and dominion one would expect, a drawing of respectable proportions, if not of great splendor. That's no masterpiece, is it? This thing is simply grotesque. And that proclaims as clearly as anything we could that we are not dealing with pictures here, but with abstractions, with conventions. We've noted before that a 10-year-old could draw the Dipper and Orion, any char, better than we find. We don't find any drawing of a constellation. Well, the Egyptians draw them, they all over the place, they observe them all the time. Two constellations that are recognizable barely are Orion and the Dipper. But heavens, my 10-year-old grandson can do a better job right off. You mean these people who study the stars so carefully couldn't do it? There's something different. They have something totally different in mind when they look at these stars. They declare it. This group doesn't depict a person with animals, but signifies a relationship of space, as we read by those words, of space, time, government, and the cosmic order. At the time the engraving was made, the hypocephalus had been damaged and the top part of the figure was missing, and the bottom pushed out of line had to be supplied, but how? Let me see if we have the others now. This is another one that shows this. Yes, this shows eight apes and so forth. Oh, more variation. Well, I see we'll have to get on later for those pictures. This is a good picture. We'll get to it pretty soon. That particularly claims, yes, because we're getting on. They're the same god. The heads must be replaced. The best possible choice. Well, the point is this. Back to the Joseph Smith now. Yes, we can go back. Hey, I'm going backwards. Hey, you're going frontwards, I'm going backwards. What's going on here? I say I'll only go back so far, eh? Ah, here we are, there we are. That's it, you see. Well. Come disconnected? I want to see that Joseph Smith from there. Yes, it's not marked on here. We have later on the overlays and so forth showing us that all this part here, all this part is missing, right down here, all this is missing. This, you see, you can see this. This is not hieroglyphic supplied. This is supplied by hieratic from the other text. This, see, the headlock amended it with that, and here it's been mended here. This part's been damaged. This was damaged. This was wiped out. That's why I didn't have the head. And this was all out. So they said, well, he just substituted a head from somewhere else. Now let me see if we can find where that would be. Yeah, that's the same one, you see. We could have used those. Well, nothing happens. Stosto. Miracles of technology here. Try to race another station, will you? See if you can get what happened. Told you so. It's supposed to be.
This is forward.
I know it's supposed to be forward.
If it's blank, then you've gone too far. It's backward.
Oh. That's a good one. I think I'm going to have to go quite a ways. Can I get back after
yes.
this? Okay. Say, I have an awful lot of the Joseph Smith ones. This is a good one. I'm going to have to go way over here. Oh, no, it'll take too far to go. There we are. See, in the church historian's office, there's an overlay that was made early of this, and it shows the parts that were missing. And you notice that our boat is not there. This part wasn't there. So did Joseph Smith just invent the boat? They said, yes, he did. Because in the Book of the Dead, chapter 101 here, from the Joseph Smith Papyri, you have the very type of boat that's supplied here. Let's see the Book of the Dead now. Here it is, you see. It's down here. Here is the boat. You said he just took this boat and, now we go back again, and moved it. Well, we can leave that. That's good. And moved it on to, we'll put here. Moved it on to here. For the pleasant reason to show that that wasn't so, this is the headlock engraving. See, he put his name on there, headlock, so that's the first engraving made. But when he made it, this was mostly there, and it's the same kind. Because, remember, we have 100 others. They all have this boat here. It's the thing that should be here. Same size as this boat in the same way. And more there's some other things about it that aren't on the other boat. The other boat has the wedge-jet eyes made very perfectly, these two wedge-jet eyes made quite perfectly, and Hedlock was a very good engraver. Why would he make such a mess of this one here? But the interesting thing is right behind here, we have written here, the ship of the God. That's not written on the other one. Did Joseph Smith decide after he forged this and put it in here, he said, let's just write an Egyptian, the ship of the God back there. That'll prove it. No. No, this was here before it was damaged. This was made before the overlay was made, after it had been damaged. So this is really part of the original. You can be sure of that for a number of reasons. So we won't bother about that. The heads were replaced. That was a common practice. Now, the figure on. So I'm going to skip down now to the idea of column here. Mentioned that he mentions Kolob. I'm going to skip a lot of stuff. Kolob, there's the blackboard over there. Excuse me, where I go and get Kolob here. Would you bring it over here? Talking on. Kolob is the one name in the explanations not designated as Egyptian, and indeed it's basically Semitic, turning up with two meanings in all the Western Semitic languages. The late Professor Zucker up at the U suggested that Smith's Kolob may be a variant of Kokob, meaning star. He was apparently unaware of the fact that it's one of the most fruitful of Semitic roots in Arabic, where the guttural first consonant gives the vowel an O sound. And let's look it up in Lane's dictionary. See, we have two words, one with K and one with Q, and they're always playing games with them. This is what we're going to have here. And one is Kolob, the K makes it that. Going to have to use heavy drawing here. That's this one. This is pronounced Kolb, and this is pronounced Kalb. They're written just alike, pronounced just alike, except that this K, this Q is a little harder. And thereon hangs a tail. Lane's Dictionary, that Kolb, the one with the Q there, Kolb, it's a verb meaning to the action of the heart, to alter, change, invert, turn upside down, turn over and over, go flip-flop, says the dictionary. The noun means heart, hence intellect or intelligence. Adjective, a genuine or pure in respect of origin or lineage, holding a middle place among the people, being in the middle. Then its third meaning is a certain bright star, Alpha Scorpio Antares, which happened for many years, when I was always thought that was the largest star, remember? 400, the red giant, that's why it's called Antares, the rival of Aries. It was called Kolb by the Arabs, and it happened to be the biggest star we knew of 400,000 miles in diameter. That's all that sort of thing when I was a kid. Now they, I think, outclassed it. But that's that star in the 18th mansion of the moon. And there are also three similar appellations to other bright stars. Regulus is called Kolb, Kolb al-Asad, heart of the lion. When Ibn Arabi, a very famous medieval Arabic, took an ascension, we didn't talk about Ibn Arabi's ascension, but when he went his ascension to heaven, his famous ascension, he found, he says, in the house of Arab, in the house of Abraham, which was also called Kolb, because it was near the throne of God, mystically shared by the hero himself, at the height and center of his own mind. He saw this in his own mind. It's an interesting thing. He finds the house of, when he goes to the vision on high, he finds the house in heaven of Abraham, and it's called Kolb. Interesting coincidence. Remember, these things are given a double interpretation by the Sufis. They are spiritual, but they are also something more, and he was a Sufi. The other great ascension was Muhammad's own, called the Mi'raj. It's a perfectly Semitic, purely Semitic root then. When you get back to early Semitic, the Indo-European shares the root with it. The explanation, called Kolb, because it is near to me, suggests some very early connections to the common Semitic Indo-European roots, where Kolb and Karab interchange, Karab being near, Karab, Akriba'un, nearest, neighbor, Karib, near, and so forth, Karab, and of course that's cognate with our word for Kolb, for being near, Indo-European, such as Old English, Clipion, Claben, Clabber, meaning to congeal, glue, cola, agglutinate, colophon, cleave, all those words, clasp and so forth, can be needed to both to be near and, well, it has a basic meaning of nearness both in Arabic and in European roots. Though the word Kolb, heart, and the Kolb dog, the other one, the soft one, are different, the ancients could not keep them apart. This is the point. If I was just bringing them together, it'd be different. But they're always making them interchange. One ancient saying, quoted in Lane, shows a more than facetious connection between the two. Is a talak or kolb, ga'ashita or kolb. The, is a talak or kolb, when the kolb, when the heart star rises, ga'ashita or kolb. There comes, the winter comes in, kolb, like a dog. When the heart star rises, winter comes in like the dog star. The two of them, they're mixing. What is significant here is that these stars are the two brightest in the heavens. Sirius is Canopus, it's the dog star, Canis Major, and Canopus is the other one, which is the also called dog star. The Arab Kolb, as with us, denotes the constellation of Canis Major, the big dog, and its principal star is Sirius, which we call the dog star. Nearby is Procyon, which we call the little dog star. To complicate things while dropping hints, Sirius, the brightest star, has as its rival for the title of Kolb, the red Antares, long been held by astronomers to be the most massive of stars. And the experts of old inevitably came to disagree as to which might be the real dog star, but they all had his name Kolb. Sirius, the sun's real twin and brightest star in the heavens, naturally qualified for a number of roles in the Egyptian manner. Santayana comments on the amazing significance of Sirius as the leader of the planets, ruling over the three worlds, unquote. But the third candidate for leadership, the second brightest of all the stars, was Canopus. It is the second brightest star. You can see it from Los Angeles, you can't see it from here. The second brightest star was Canopus. And if you could see any star from Los Angeles now, you'd have to go at least to Mount Wilson, wouldn't you? Your second brightest star was kind of a switch. For the Egyptians, was the heart star par excellence. The Egyptians, that was Canopus. They called it the heart star. And the Arabs also called it Kav. Thus we see how heart and dog get switched. The Egyptians designated Canopus by drawing a picture of a human heart suspended as a bob on a plumb line. Now we can go back to that picture we passed by here. See if we can get back to it. We'll get to these later. This is a much later story. Hey, come on. This is the one. It shows on the Joseph Smith Papyrus number 5, but it is so dim that it won't show on the screen here. But this is a good one from the Ani Papyrus. They say we can make it, focus it here. Yeah, we can focus. Uh-huh. There. Now this is what happens here. You see. This is, the Egyptians designated Canopus by drawing the picture of a human heart suspended as a bob on a plumb line, the cosmic plumb line from which all the universe was measured. Again, Giorgi Santayana puts it, the determinative sign for heart often figures as the plumb bob at the end of the plumb line coming from the well-known astronomical device, the Egyptian Merkit. Evidently, heart is something very specific, as it were, the center of gravity for the universe. He says. Here he refers to the Werther book, where the basic idea of the heart is given, not surprisingly, as the middle, the center. So which is it to be, Sirius or Canopus? Well, this is Canopus. This is the heart, you see. This is the heart, and it's weighing the person's soul, but he is steadying. This is also a heart. This is the plumb line, you see. It's the heart that steadies everything. Everything depends on it. And the ape up here is doing a very important thing. He holds the heart, as we shall see. For southern regions, Canopus gets the nod. The Arabs also had another name for Canopus. Besides, they called it Kalbataman, Ta'al-Ataman, the heart of the south, or Suhail al-Wezen, the little adjuster of the scales, and that's what that is. That's what the Arabs call Suhail. Sahala means to make straight, and Suhail is the diminutive, al-Wezen, that's the scales. So he's the Suhail al-Wezen. He's the one that makes sure that the thing is standing upright, so that it'll give proper measurement, you see. So he does it by balancing a star, and Anubis is holding it. On the other hand, what's being weighed here is the heart, too. It's the person's own essence, his own soul, and everything else is his heart. So we're weighing a heart against the spirit. Remember, that's shu, that's spirit, that's mat, that's truth, and all those other things. That's your spirit person and your earth life. That's your carnal nature, and that's your spiritual nature, and they're going to match them up. But it must be level, and so Anubis steadies the swinging heart here, the swinging bob, which represents, for them, Canopus, the bright star, which is in the center of things, and the little adjuster of the scales here, or as Santayana puts it, Canopus ponderosus, suggesting to him that Canopus, quote, was the weight and the end of at the end of the plumb line, the star by means of which the depth of the universe was measured, the central star of everything, colon, which is interesting. Santayana further notes that the measuring operation was carried on by Hephaestus, who was the Greek Kunun, as far as that goes, and he was the creator, who consulted the dimensions of the universe before designing the shield of Achilles. And Santayana actually mentions the shield of Achilles, which we associate quite closely, you see, with Hypersephalus. That comes in there, too. The great weight of the Canopus ponderosus explains why, quote, of all stars, it alone was taken for static, exempt from precession. Everything went around it. It didn't move. The primordial star called L'Etoile Immobile. Yet, in Egypt, Sirius was also immune from precession. So we have the rival of these two, and they're both called Kalb. One is called Kalb with a Q, one is called Kalb with a K, and vice versa. One is called Kalb with a K, and the other called vice with a Q. They're juggling it around, but they're talking about this central star, and they give it that interesting name of Colum. In view of the immense conservatism of star nomenclature, let's to assume the Arabic star, Suhail al-Wezen, goes back to the Egyptians, who make sure that everything in the cosmos is properly balanced. Now that's why we have our two apes properly in the Joseph Smith. They had a cynocephalus ape sit atop the center post or column supporting the scale assemblage, and there he is sitting there, you see. That's right. The animal held a plumb line with the heart suspended on the other end to make sure the thing was absolutely vertical. To match this, officiating over the measurement of mass and matter, we have the same figure presiding over the measure of time. Now I tried to get, I think there was one in our Ramses collection. You always have the same ape sitting over a water clock to make sure that the thing is upright, that fills the vessel upright and so forth. And he's supposed to urinate every hour on the hour. But he has charge of time to make sure that it's exact. He makes sure that time and measurements are exact. To match this, we have the same figure presiding over the measurement of time, for the ape must sit atop the Egyptian water clocks to measure the hours exactly by regular and frequent urination into a marked basin. So we're back to cubits and days, swinging pendulums that use the mass of the earth for a measure of the field, and the water clock is another way of measuring. Note that it's the seated ape who presides over both the water clock and the plumb line scale. Brooks notes that the Egyptians wrote the word for hour by a heart-shaped plumb bob suspended by a carpenter square. This suggests that the ape must face each other, which face each other on the either side. It shouldn't be hard to find a Joseph Smith hypocephalus here, should it? If we go back a little. Just a couple. This one will do it. This one will do it. There it is, you see. Now, you see what these apes do. Of course, these apes are praising. They recognize balance, but they bear on their heads both the sun and the moon, and it is their hands are raised in praise at the dawn when the sun comes over the cliffs. You know, the apes line the cliffs to catch the first morning light and hold their hands up to warm themselves in the light of the sun. That's their prayer, greeting the sun. Of course, they raise a howling at the same time. So the Egyptians in the earliest times used that as a symbol for salutation to the sun. And that's what they're doing here. They're saluting him in his rising, but they also assure the balance of the universe here. Can't go into that, but man is still a measure of all things. A recent study of Egyptian heart, well, this is one by Debuck. Debuck says the heart scarabs, remember the heart scarabs are by the minions in Egypt. They emphasize the doctrine that for the Egyptians the heart was the seat of all human existence. It represents, wrote Debuck, the totality of life and the manifestation of life, the essence of every personality. Well, a very important writing called the Sefer Yetzirah, anciently attributed to Abraham. Most rabbis still think it was written by Abraham, the oldest Hebrew book. It says that above time is the Sefer, the Galgal, and above the body is the heart. The heart is the central part of the world organism, says the Zohar, around which all things revolve everlastingly. It's the center of the universe as the heart is the center of the man. Man is the microcosm containing in himself the equivalent of the sun, moon, and stars. So this is all connecting it with you personally. Remember, everyone had his own pattern of habits. It was very secret. And they wanted to get it as near to you as possible. So your head rested on it, got as near to you as possible when you were laid away. And the center universe is the heart of the center of the man. Man is the microcosm. Well, and so it goes, and so it goes. That was the largest. Well, anyway, Kolob, some symbol, brings all things together in one at the judgment, the grandiose conception. But it is our own. Well, I'm going to skip Synesius here. If you have time, the better things. It would seem that Joseph Smith hasn't done badly with Kolob, even if the name is in its many striking relevant connections, could only be a happy accident. The rest of it is all in place, the crowned figure in the center of the cosmic circle, representing the first of all the creative power, also the governing power, by whom time and space were measured and structure was revealed in the stars. All this, along with the graphic design, is basic to thinking of the Egyptians and Hebrews alike, and they would agree that Joseph Smith had given a satisfactory explanation of what they believe. This equating of time and space proves a most impressive control over Joseph Smith's explanation. and bids us ask ourselves whether the whole thing could not be something more than a lucky guess after all. He says, the measurement of time according to celestial time, which celestial time signifies one day to a cubit. We have already shown how Petrie explained the derivation of the cubit of 29.161 inches from, quote, a pendulum which swung 100,000 times in 24 hours in the latitude in which Memphis lies. Only we haven't explained it. We should have explained it by this. So, bring that over, will you? We'll show you what Petrie... Now, Petrie was a professional surveyor before he became an Egyptologist, and he went to Egypt specifically to get the measurements of the Great Pyramid. But he found there how the Egyptian... Now, remember, Joseph Smith says the measurement according to celestial time represents one day, a day is time, to a cubit. A cubit is space. And Petrie shows how the Egyptian got the cubit. How any Egyptian could get it, he says. Here is a cubit on a side. This is a pendulum which swings 100,000 times a day. If you've got a pendulum swinging then you've got a cubit. All you have to do is swing a pendulum that does 100,000 times a day, and you can break it down. You don't have to stand all day counting, you know. And sure enough, you'll have an Egyptian cubit of 29.161 inches at the latitude in which Memphis lies. And yet Petrie the surveyor explains how, with nothing more than a shadow stick and a plumb line, we're quoting him, there would have been no difficulty to the Egyptians in developing the use of a familiar plumb line to find the result. In fact, the division of the days are marked by the peasant today, by putting a stick upright in the ground and marking where its shadow falls. That circular time and space are measured in the same units, minutes and seconds of arc, far more evident than the subtle relationship of the Egyptian cubit to the length of the day, which somehow didn't escape Joseph Smith's informant. See, the Egyptians measured, make a cubit equivalent to a day, and that's where you measure. Well, then there's a statement, one day in Kolob is equal to 1,000 years. That's the great year of the ancients. They worked out all sorts of cycles. The rim of the hypocephalus presents, among other things, the great phoenix cycle, which is 360,000 years. The hierarchical arrangement is the explanation of a 1,000-to-1 relationship. He says 1,000-to-1, remember. Again, matching time and space is set forth in the Talmud, where God says to Israel, I have made 12 constellations in the sky, and for every constellation I have 30 hosts, and for every host 30 legions, each composed of 30 camps, and each castrum of 360,000 myriads of 10,000 stars, which correspond to the days of the solar year. Mount up. The same extravagance is expressed by those wisest of Arabs, the brethren of Basra, who report that every star makes the circuit of 36,000 years, while all the stars together in Aries, the ram's horn again, you see, make the new creation every 360,000 years, 1,000 years to a day. This was traditional, in other words. The whole Kolob concept suggests that archaic order, we're quoting Sadian again, which today is being retrieved through the study of the oldest myths, monuments, and so forth. He says, as we follow the clues, stars, numbers, writes Santayana, a huge framework of connections is revealed at many levels. One is inside an echoing manifold where everything responds and everything has a place assigned to it. This is a true edifice, a world image that fits many levels, all of them kept in order by strict measure. Now that concept of unity and identity so prominent in the Egyptian text is beautifully expressed in Joseph Smith in Moses 6:63, the Pearl of Great Price. Behold, all things have their likeness, and all things are created and made to bear record of me. Notice, puts everything into its place here. Both things which are temporal and things which are spiritual, things which are in the heavens above and things which are on the earth, things which are in the earth, things which are under the earth, and things which, all things bear record of me. Such is the echoing manifold we have here. It's the Genesis principle we talked about, which principle is never separate from hierarchy. Well, let's get a figure two here. Got to get on. Where's the clock? Oh, brother. Well, figure two, we can go faster then. What about figure two? The motive of figure one carries on here. First, notice what Joseph Smith has to say about it. This figure stands next, There it is, see. This figure, the one at the top, they're numbered, you see. This figure stands next to Kolob, the next grand governing creation, near to the place where the God resides. Compare this to figure one, which is Kolob, the first creation, not the next, but the first. It is nearest to the residence of God. It's not there, it is near, but it is the next closest, nearest. So we're going in a series, a hierarchy here. Number two isn't as near, but it has the same power and authority. More than one space, we have distance. More than space, we also have distance in time here. We're told this is the first creation beyond the steps or degrees of authority, the next grand governing creation. See, the one in the center is called the first creation, and the one is the next grand governing creation. So we're getting a hierarchy of things here. It seems neither one is dead center. Figure one is nearer, figure two is nearest, but it says it's nearest to the residence of God isn't there. You will find figure two also holds the key and power also pertaining to the other planets. This is the Janus planets. This is the Janus principle of hierarchy too. I'm wondering whether to mention the key now, Miftah. Yes, good. Notice the thing which he calls, which he's holding here, we've mentioned 100 times, is wep-wawet. The word wep means open, our word ope. Same thing, ope thine eyes, and winking merry buds begin to ope their golden eyes. I'd sing it, but I'm hoarse tonight. We have wep and wawet is the way, of course. But wep is ope, and fatah, of course, in Hebrew is open. Fatah is in Hebrew or Arabic, is a key, and a miftah is a key, an opener. A wepu is an opener in Arabic, and it means Egyptian, it means key, and miftah is an opener, it means key. Joseph says this is a key, and of course when you say this is wep-wawet, this is the opener, what does a key do? It is the opener, it opens. This is properly a key, is what you have here. And let me get back to that anyway. The third chapter of the book of Abraham has much to say about these hierarchies. Notice the theme of one thing above another, and another above that, repeated a number of times. All is division and proportion and relativity. I have set this one to govern over those which belong to the same order as that on which thou standest, is Abraham 3:3, you see. All is relative, being measured from the place where Abraham is taking his sightings. Different realms have different times and seasons, we're told, each with its own manner of reckoning. We're told that too. In a fixed relationship or portion, 3:4, Abraham 3:4, according to the reckoning of another order. Note how the dividing and structuring is carried on in some detail as higher and lower orders are matched by shorter and longer revolutions of times, the set time of greater bodies. All this, of course, suggests a sort of relativity. 7 times Abraham is reminded that what he sees is only to be understood with reference to the earth upon which thou standest, just from your point of view, just your cone of time, you see, which implies a general principle of universal law. The principle is repeatedly put forth in the rule of endless successions. That's another one of first, where Joseph says in 3:8, where 2 facts exist, there shall be another fact above them. In this case, another planet, whose reckoning time shall be longer still. So if one goes, there'll be another, and there's no stopping. Our knowledge on Earth is limited to the planets of one particular order alone, he tells us in the next verse, albeit it's geared to other systems beyond our ken. Does that take us out of our planetary system to the sun? Yes, they do have a super heaven, the Egyptians do. And this says, this takes us only, notice, it said, until thou come nigh unto Kolob. Because Kolob is a different frame of reference, a different kind of thing, which is after the reckoning of the Lord's time, nigh unto the throne of God. What applies to the universe within our comprehension is limited, quoting Joseph again, to all those planets which belong to the same order as that which thou standest. You're not going to understand any others, that just yours. You're stuck with that. And that's not a small thing, however, until you move on. Abraham is introduced to an order of stars and planets similar to the one on which he belongs. The rest for the present is none of his business, as the Lord tells Moses, brought him down to earth. He says, I've done these things for my own purposes. Wisdom stays in me. Don't ask more. After he was shown everything terrestrial, celestial, and what could possibly relate to this earth, he wanted to know, well, this is the Moses story, where the Lord says, for mine own purpose, here is wisdom, and it remaineth in me. Well, then I would say that, no. Well, he saw a bigger slice of the universe than we do. When the Lord put his hand over Abraham's eyes, then he saw endless expanse, but I could not see the end thereof. He did not see it all. Even in this boundless realm, the same rules prevail where they do in our little corner of the cosmos. The same relationship of stars and satellites prevails everywhere. These regions, in the 13th verse, these regions are suggested to Abraham as possible accommodations for his endless posterity. Again, an endless progressive series, we learn to our surprise that Kolob is after all not the center of everything, or the greatest of all, but only, quoting in the 17th verse here, but only the greatest of all, the Kokabim, that thou hast seen. That's all. There's a limiting clause right there, you see. The greatest of all the stars that you have seen. In the endless series is repeated again in the next verse. And then comes the important announcement that our time scale or conception has no application out there at all. He says, if there are two spirits, notwithstanding one is more intelligent than the other, they have no beginning, their existence they shall have no end, shall have existed after, for they are Nolam Olam, which is eternal. Well, the double-faced figure wearing the Tachenon crown then, which combines the double feathers, Ammon's distinguishing feature, with the ram's horn, striding forward, the ram of heaven in his aspect, this is number two, is by all accounts the true Janus figure. Classical writers referred to him and such, so forth. Now, this is, notice his crown is supposed to be emblematical, the two feathers, emblematical of the grand presidency in heaven. And indeed the two feathers are the prime emblem of celestial light and spirit and truth, the three. See, that's the mat feathers, the shoe feathers, the light feathers, and the shad feathers, and the light feathers, and the spirit feathers. Significantly, the shoe feather is not a theological, but an astronomical symbol. And Anthesis, he noticed that never, if this feather is never written, you find it here, you find it all the time, that it's never written with the familiar divinity sign. It's never written as a personal god. It's a pure abstraction. Rather, it represents actual sunlight, not abstraction, or light that traverses and fills the space between heaven and earth. The light, to quote Joseph Smith, pertaining to other planets. The sign of the two feathers did, however, enjoy a very wide range of interpretation among the Egyptian scribes, who gave it all kinds of interpretations. Incidentally, the same figure is usually designed as the presiding or holding the presidency. His title is Khentamenti. He's not, well, let's find one in which he's wearing. It's been damaged there. He should be wearing the Atif. Oh, there he's wearing the Atif crown. There he's wearing it, see? This very glorious crown that combines everything, the two feathers and everything else. We're told about this represents him as king of Khentamenti. Well, Khent means in front of, seated in front of, which is the word president. Presidens, sitting before, and Khentamenti means sitting before the spirits in heaven. The presidency of heaven is what this means, Khentamenti. And Joseph Smith says this is the sign that signifies the presidency of heaven. The very same term, almost the Egyptians gave it. Yes, that's what it signifies, the Khentamenti, the one who sits in the presence of the heavenly beings. Well, and the eight rams and so forth, we'll bother about them. Let's see, there's something else in two that might be interesting here, yes. These epaulettes these creatures wearing. Get back to the Joseph. Notice he's wearing them too. They look, in this case, they look like a couple of jackals. Now we try some of the others. What do they look like there? We seem to enjoy some liberty of choice here. He doesn't have any, you'll notice. None at all. Can't see his. Oh, wait a minute. This is the Joseph Smith one. They look like branches or twigs, strange things coming out. What are they? Here and here. And So we have to turn where we can find them, you know, and this is brings a very interesting thing in. Here we see a Babylonian motif, yes. Now here's the Babylonian equivalent to this. You notice he has light rays rising, coming out of his shoulder. And here we have the same thing. He's opening the gates. He is coming out of the mountain. He's emerging. He's the same type of God, only he's in Babylonia. See, they're opening the gates of day for him to come through. Here are the stars. Here's the new moon period. There, everything is correlated here. And the gates and the horned. Notice, it's the bull's horns and not the goat's horns. The ram, the bull, the heavenly twins. Remember, in the zodiac, the bull follows the ram, and the ram comes first and then it's the bull. The Babylonians come later. 2,000 years it takes for a jump, you know. 26,000 for it to go clear around. But here we have these, I want to talk about these things just a second, because they're rather interesting. These appear on Babylonian seals that are actually older, Mesopotamian seals, older than Hypocephali proper. Here we see the horned crown god emerging from between two mountains. Ah, here we are. Resembling the Egyptian Acht symbol of the rising sun. See, that's the Egyptian horizon symbol he's on. Two horned genies accompany the signs of the new moon, stand on either side, like figures 22 and 23, like our two apes. That would. They are opening wide the two gates, halves of the gate, while the god holds a key. Notice, he is holding what's called a key here. Now this is Mortgat, who wrote the big study on this. A key with which he opens the doors of heaven, or else it is a saw with which he will deliver himself from the underworld. He either has a key to open the doors of heaven or a saw to deliver himself in the famous harrowing of hell. The Lord smashes the gates out down to deliver the spirits in heaven, you see. But why does he need to smash them? He has the key. He goes down and opens them. The other version just opens them with the key. Well, here he has a saw to saw himself out if he must, or the key to open the way. Mortgat cites Egyptian parallels. He says they got it from Egypt, in which Osiris holds a saw for the same purpose, to get out of the underworld. From either shoulder, the god three wavy lines protrude, suggesting odd objects on the shoulders of our figure two, which have been interpreted in other hypocephali as plants representing new vegetation, or as feathers, or as a bird's head in some of them, a jackal in the one we saw. Do we have some others that suggest other things? Yes, here. Yes, what is that? What on earth is that that's coming out of his shoulders? Not the same thing. One is a snake. This is from a lengthy study, a monograph by Frothingham, in which he goes into this thing. Here's a snake here. He thinks it has to be two snakes, a horned viper and something. And these are the two snakes that form the caduceus, you see, which comes from, he says, from Babylonia. But in both cases, we have the sun emerging at the beginning of a new day, age or year, familiar association of classic Janus figure. At the top of the Maeterlinck stele, in the half circle, are familiar hypocephalous figures with the inscription, Adoration to Re Horus, the solar mount, the great god, lord of heaven, giver of light, issuing from the solar mount. The staff is also a key, and the word meftach gives it away, opener, web gives it away. Joseph Smith calls it the key of power in this case. The same power that bursts upon the world at sunrise to inaugurate the new cycle of life. That's brought out very clearly in that section 162 of the Book of the Dead, the handbook to the hypocephalus. It is preeminently the key of power, opening the way and sending forth endless energy of the sun, for the ram is, we're quoting someone here, the symbol of unlimited vitality of the sun at the zenith. It always goes back to the ram and his horns. And this introduces us to another important statement in the explanation, highly relevant to the situation, meaning that as the key of power was revealed of God to Abraham as he offered sacrifice upon an altar. That's interesting. For the Jews, the ram, you know, was the supreme sacrificial offering, the perfect substitute for Isaac, the sign of resurrection. It wouldn't have been Isaac's sacrifice that we're talking about, though. The ram in the thicket which delivered Isaac from the Akedah is our own deliverance in the resurrection. For the Jews as well as the Egyptian, the ram stood, it was the resurrection. The ram's horn will be blown as the trumpet that summons the dead from the grave. For it was the ram that appeared miraculously at the moment of Isaac's death on the altar and thus delivered him from death, to resurrection, actually. Sure doesn't look like a key, but let's recall the ram's horns are worn by figures 1 or 2 in Ier Hypocephalus. Both those representations combine Ammon, Re, Osiris, the king, any other glorious personage in a single image. The description of the one who overcomes the power of death as the ram of rams before whom stand the eight in praise with the four faces on one neck from Mende is plainly our figure 1, while the double feathers worn by figure 2 show him as Shu, the image of Re, who is also to be found seated in the interior of his father's eye. Well, figure 3 has some more important things to show us. So we had to skip some there. Now, that's the one. Oh, we talked about the ship that's missing. Oh dear, go back to that one then. And, well, let me see now. I'm going forward here. No, I'm going backward. Backward, turn backward, oh, time and I fly. You've got a long way to make me a boy again just for tonight. We've got Joseph Smith now. Oh, come on, Joseph Smith. Ah, there we are. See that one up in the corner? Back to it again, the one that was damaged and all that. About the overlay and so forth. The proportions are all correct and the size is correct and so forth. Now what's going on is this. This is different on all of them. This has the greatest variety. And there's a great exchange going around. They're always passing something around. Here you notice, these are the two wedge-out eyes. They take care of it. But the sun with the solar disk. I want to get to that, the activity. There are hypocephalus, such as the well-drawn one in the British Museum, in which both seated figures on the boat and the disc or crown, are facing the direction, in the ship of God here. According to the Joseph Smith, it is made to represent God sitting upon his throne, clothed with power and authority, with a crown of eternal life on his head. Well, of course, it's the sun on his head. It repeats the leading motif of figure 1. God seated, clothed, all over again. Why all over again? God seated, clothed with power and authority, holding a scepter, which in this case is the West Scepter, for which Faulkner calls, he holds the West Scepter here, which Faulkner calls dominion, and which Gardner calls lordship. In either case, power and authority, you see. The enthroned God appears again in figure 7. Here he is, again down here. Also on the throne. Well, isn't that rather overdoing it? Same God in all those different situations? Well, that's the established Egyptian way. In this particular section, other hypocephali show the ship with the same figures in various positions, sometimes adding or omitting an item. It's usual for apes and scarabs to adorn the scene, reminding us that this is the moon bark as well as the sun ship. Not to worry, both lay claim to the crown of eternal life. Now we have to look at some of the others as an example here, what we have. Some of the other hypocephali. There you see, it's the ship on this side. We got this backwards, that's all right. See, there it's the Heifer beetle, shows becoming. There is the cabin here, and there's a picture, there's the Ba here, and there is the same worshiping figure in the Joseph Smith one. And here's one, see, there is the beetle, and there is the cabin, and nothing else in particular. And here's another one. There, yeah, he's just sitting there in majesty. Who's rowing down here? And an ape is worshiping him. The ape is with him. See, the ape is the moon. He is thought as the moon, just as he's your time measure, but especially he takes that form. And here he is, Horus, as the sun. The new Horus is facing the moon. Now we'll see, there is a very, if we can find some more of these things now, if we can get 16 frames a second, we'll have a movie. Here's one. Yes. Here's the boat. The boat's upside down, but here we have the ape. See, here we have the seated lion-maned, hawk's-headed figure in ours with the crown of light on his head. But he's with a heifer beetle. A heifer means changing your form while keeping, that's what the moon does, while keeping your identity. always Kepler there, and the ape is worshiping the Kepler because he represents the moon. See, this is exchange between sun and moon. We have some other. Well, here's a good example. Here is the boat, you see, and the eye, the wedge-out eye, the completed eye, the eye of the full moon, the eye in which everything is restored, is riding in the boat. This is the moon up here. Notice this is the lunar disk, and they're both supported in the boat and dominated by the Kepler. That's the completion of the changes, and the dominant figure here, of course, is the beetle itself, which is change. This is change, this is completion of change, these are the phases of the moon, and this is the ship. The only way you travel, of course, the moon is the like the Maga boat, it's the sickle-shaped ship that sails through the skies. Remember, the Egyptians lived on the river. The only way they got anywhere was in boats. That means passing through space. If you move anywhere, especially through suspension, a boat is suspended in space. It's suspended between the upper world and the lower world. You're just hanging there. It's quite dramatic on clear water, but it's the same thing here. All your heavenly motions, all your motions must be represented by boats. So we have lots of boats in some of these, and various people on them. Can't analyze them here. But this is brought out by the wedge-out eyes that flanked the god in the Joseph Smith boat. There were two of these, remember, flanking him there. The king's progress by ship, the wedge-out eye as the eye of Horus, overcomes the darkness both as the sun and as the moon. The high point of the mystery drama, according to Joachim Spiegel, wrote a lot about it, is the fusion of the king's nature with the god of heaven, which takes place when the statue is crowned with the moon eye of Upper Egypt and the sun eye of Lower Egypt. Amun the Ba is the right disk, then Amun the Ba is his wedge, is the left, is the wedge-out, and that's this room, which shows that the moon has completed its circle. The living ruler of the stars, who divines the seasons, who divides the seasons, months, and years. If anything, the moon is even more obvious, earnest of resurrection than the sun, because you can see it renew itself 12 times more obviously than the other. The disk seems quite obvious as a crown of eternal light. Yet Joseph Smith's critics have pointed out that it would be an easy one. Guess or not, he got it right. Along with two wedge-out eyes, which stand for the morning and evening sun on his, sun and the moon, is the well-known Egyptian principle which Henry Frankfurt calls multiple approaches and so forth. Represented by the cynocephalus ape, we have him. We should have an ape here somewhere, shouldn't we? Well, we just have to look back to another one then, but we don't want to waste too much time. Yes, well, it's upside down, but there, the ape is always worshiping there. And so we put these figures together, and as a lively handing around of the wedge-out eye is the thing. The only barking parrot, well, we have the Paris one. Let's see if we get another one here. Here's another one. This doesn't have the boats on it, see? I'm missing. There, we saw that one before. But see, the ape here is worshipped. It's sitting in a shrine, and the god is standing up in here, the ape. But you notice what the ape is doing. The ape is presenting a wedge-out eye to the ape who is here. And the next one, this one, we have here the outspread wings, and here he is in a booth, and here he's worshipping another ape who has a wedge-out eye for a head. See, the thing is, you've had 100 different exchanges of wedge-out eyes here. You can't go into them all, naturally. But what is this brisk and lively exchange going on? This is what goes on in the solar system when we're down low. Figure 5 and 7. In the Joseph Smith. You notice Joseph Smith, figure 7. Joseph Smith, when we're by here, if there is. I want to go on to another. 3 or 4 or 5 boats. Professor Horning insists that every boat stands for the same thing, transport through space in a state of suspension. They are all solar barks. Whether they're 1, 2, or 3 boats, the other half of the circle, the colonist order is 2 boats in the reverse half. They are represented prow to prow and were long thought to represent sun and moon bark, but now today it's agreed they represent that moment of passage, always that crucial moment of passage of resurrection when the evening bark becomes the morning bark. And they're one and the same ship. Figure 3 here. Okay. What this all amounts up to, summed up by Morantz, Siegfried Morantz, the figure on the throne is Re Harakhti, and the inscription sometimes informs us, that's one of the sun in his head, that he is both Re and Horus as the new sun king, Horus of the horizon. The horizon is the moment of passage denoted by the name of Khepri, and that's the figure of the beetle. As for the ape, he is Thoth. I am Thoth, the eldest son of Re, who Adam begot, who rose out of Khepri. I have come down to earth within the secrets of Harakhti. The secrets of Harakhti, the horizon. Oh, my land. For Hassan, Thoth in the boat gives a glimpse of profound thinking and prophetic expression. Here, too, we find reconciliation of the Osiris mysteries with a solar cult. Back to the old kingdom, the defunct Eunus remains in the coffin chamber of his pyramid only long enough to undergo rapid transformation, during which he briefly assumes the name of Osiris, who is dead. Then he relinquishes it upon leaving the sarcophagus chamber. At dawn he goes out under the new identification of Horus, the son of Osiris. The whole course of the fearful passage to the underworld and back is described in the inscriptions in terms of a ship journey, he said. Well, there were some migration of souls. It's too late, isn't it? There's one good thing on it. There's one time for one more good thing. I'm going to skip and show you one. So, something which is... Oh, there's lots of stuff here, but figure four. What should we talk about figure four here? I'm going to talk about... figure four is important. We have to consider him. Nevertheless, I'm going to jump way ahead to 5, 6, 7. Back to Joseph Smith again. Maybe we can get another one if you go forward. Oh, here, notice, here's one which is just a boat, all the gods riding on, just riding on a boat. And it's a hypocephalus, too. You have to have it. And there's another one. That's a beauty, you see. Look at how the boats dominate there. There he's presenting the wedge-out eye to the one in the booth. And here, the same principle again. You notice that it's the boat in heaven which is holding the sun. But then here is, this is Horus here. Oh, excuse me, I pressed the wrong button. This is Horus here. Those take such time. This is Horus, and he's upside down because he's coming down to the underworld to a night. Notice he's bringing the rays of light, of starlight, down to, we saw this one before, to enlighten the Lord, Lord of the Lord of the heaven, Lord of the stars. This is the two mothers who were to revive him. Here's the Anak symbol. But the pink thing is that the goat is the intermediary. All right, I will go back to number four. And then these wings above are very important here, because this goes back to an image that goes back from the first dynasty to about 2840 BC. We find a good picture of this. But you notice the boat here. This is a child. This is an unborn child in the womb. It's going to be the sun child. It's going to be born, you see. And the ape is preparing. Notice he's holding the life symbol. And the woman is preparing. She is Isis. She is Isis. She's going to deliver him. He's on the horizon, just at the point passing between the worlds. I got fish here to show that he's in Nun, the waters of the celestial ocean. But down below, these are the three worlds. This is the super heaven. This is what's in between, which is mobile, which is the boat, which is unstable. This is the temporal world. It just goes. And this is the world in which you sleep, but not for long, you see. The breakthrough is made here. Let's see what the next one is. Well, there's just the bird alone. And this one. Well, let's look at our figure four then. This is our figure four, which was... Wait, where we got a figure four here? There's more of the stuff going on. Well, anyway, no, I've got to go back to figure four, sorry. This is getting to be something of a fiasco, but this is the way it goes. Come on. I've got to get Joseph Smith again. I have four or five of him strewn around here. This will do, but it's upside down, so we'll have to go to the next one. This is just about... There's a good one. There's the Heperu. There's the beetle that dominates right in the moon, you see. This is the Paris one. We'll get there. But still, it's upside down. It's this one we're talking about. Still upside down. Come on. My lad, we're going forever. Still upside down. This is this one, you see. I wanted to show you this one. This is called Recovery Review. At last we reach Joseph Smith. He makes so much better sense than anyone else, you see. And that's this one here. He's rising. This is number four, and this is, so I'll go back to him after all. Yeah. This is Sokar, of course, who's writing. The whole complex would seem to be now. Figure four is another form of the same God in transition. Fortunately, Professor Kitchen and Gabala have made a thorough study of the figure. He is Sokar at the New Year, his time identified with the various archaic New Year boats who mentioned him. The whole complex would seem to be dedicated, says Professor Gabala. Professor Gabala had a nice talk with him, a long walk we had up at Sundance. He is perhaps the foremost scholar of Egyptian religion in Cairo. He's not in Cairo now. And he said to me, you know, we got talking around, he said, you know, we Egyptians, we're Mohammedans and so forth, but we believe in the old Egyptians too. We believe what your people believe, he said. He kept that very much under. These old Egyptians really had something, he said. And he was no fool, the Gabala. Well, he says, the said festival of the Jubilee, the emphasis on the king's renewal. The very instant when the dead having reached the lowest possible moment, that's the Sokar thing that we saw in the Janus story. In his journey, reverses direction. The idea is most potently symbolized. The bird on the boat is rising with outspread wings, and he's breaking out of the coverings. He's breaking, shedding the mummy wrappings that enveloped his legs. Sokar's great festival, as our authorities tell us, fused with that of Osiris. Everything is at an end, but the next day, the first day of the new year, Horus mounts up, throne guaranteeing the rightful rule of Pharaoh. It's the old king resurrected in the new. It was at dawn on the day of the winter solstice, after a night of mourning, that Sokar Osiris arose and made his union with the solar disk, just as it struck the top of the benstone, that benstone that's three times on the rim of the Joseph Smith Hypocephalus. It was the most sacred and probably the oldest monument of Heliopolis that we were talking about there. When at Alexandria, at the winter solstice, 365 lamps were lit, five ships were paraded in procession with the ship of Sokar leading the parade. That's to begin the new age, the new eternity, followed by Isis, Nephthys, Horus, and Thoth. Same as the Janus candles at Rome in the procession of the Janus ship. Even more significant is this to resemblance to figure three, which resembles it exactly. The crouching Sokar bird is Khonsu. He is Khonsu, who is, from earliest times, represents the passage between the heavenly bodies from one place to another, meaning Khonsu, he who traverses the sky, that is. It's Khonsu is the moon. In the litanies of Sokar, they identify the figure. Hail, Prince coming forth from the womb, Lord of time, giver of years. Hail, son of Re, boat of millions, who is in the underworld, waxing moon in the evening bark, Lord of the Hennu boat, becoming young in the secret ship, the hidden one, unknown to the vulgar. He's coming to life here, and it's part of the mysteries too. And about the wings, we almost forgot, the other hawk has wings, but they're not spread out. This complex figure satisfies the requirements of both figures 3 and 4. The outspread wings are not primarily for transportation. They are Himmelsflügel. This is where Joseph Smith scores some wonderful hits here. Himmelsflügel, the eternal round of the heavens, is like the horned one. Thy body is with thee. Our figure 4, quote, is the great god of the dappled plumage. On many of them, it shows he's showed dappled here. He isn't here. Lord of the sky and of the earth, he grants life, stability, and prosperity. Figure 4 goes back to the earliest Egyptian iconography found on an ivory comb of King Jet from about 2840 BC. I've got to go clear back to that because it's important to show you this. Because Joseph Smith makes some beautiful scores here. Count on. Here we go, we're getting there. Now, That's the socar bark there, you see. And this is that, notice this is the ivory comb of King Jet, King Snake, from the first dynasty, very beginning, in which we see the Himmelsfalken, the heaven falcon, in his boat, sailing over the heavens. Now that's very old, and it goes right back to the beginning. Boat beneath which two wings representing the sky are spread. It is the sunship on the wings of the sky, the two outstretched wings above the earth, the sheltering wings of the sky god, from which is later delivered the idea of the hawk as the sky god. Schaeffer identified the same wings as the falcon wings as symbolic of the sky. But Piankov goes even further. Well, let's take what Joseph Smith says here. Joseph Smith says, answers to the Hebrew word rakia, the way they spelled it phonetically here, rakia, signifying expanse or firmament of heaven. When he studies this in King Tut's tomb, Alexander Piankov says, this had best be described by the Hebrew word rakia, to express the idea of the expanse of the starry heavens. Word for word what Joseph Smith tells us it is. He says, he even uses the Hebrew word to express it, rakia, as the best expression, as the expanse of the starry heavens. I say that's what Joseph Smith calls it too. Then he goes on and says another strange thing. It answers to this Jep's comb, the two outstretched wings above, the sheltering wings of the sky god. Well, all these guys writing about saying that represents the sky, in other words, the sky goddess. And then we get on to this, because she's identical also as the sky goddess. Oh, did I do that? Oh, that's more of your cow. Well, let's go back to the sky goddess then. She is the sky, the cow there. Damn. Shucks. Well, but I have her, well, there she is as the sky goddess. There she is spreading her wings as the sky goddess. Pulling out life, and there's your wedge out eye, and there's your ram's heads, and there's your boat on this, all the stuff's there, and there's your worshiping apes, quite a congregation of symbols. But this is the lady who represents the heavens with her outspread wings, the same wings we saw on the comb of King Jet. So it says, this writer says, the bird in the boat is sometimes represented as the sky goddess Nut, whose outstretched wings are the symbols of protection, their purpose being to enfold and embrace everything. So far, so good. But Joseph says this also, a numerical figure in Egyptian signifying 1,000. Well, you might ask, for highly trained both Bear Wilson, and even Mike Rose said they never heard of this, any Egyptian 1,000 having anything to do with this. Well, I haven't looked very far in this particular direction because, well, there's so much to look for anyway. For here, if ever, Joseph Smith's right on target. As we've seen, the outstretched heavens are symbolized by the wings of Nut, the sky goddess. This woman has a peculiar name, and the name by which she goes is given to the ship figure is Ka-ba-es. Oh, we don't need to worry about that. Ka-ba-es. Which means literally Ka, 1,000, Ba, soul, S, hers. The one with 1,000 souls, or 1,000 are her souls, it's written by different people. She's so called because the stars are her children. A pyramid text says, Nut reveals the gods to herself and lets them sink, a nautical term again, as the one with 1,000 souls, lest they depart from her as stars. So may Enen, that's the buried king, may he not be removed from thee in his name of the distant one in the sky. He might not leave her 1,000 children. She has counted, the pyramid text goes on, she has counted her children in her name of Lady of Heliopolis. The stela of one Nefibuset Wasritz reads, ye shall be as an imperishable star, a star that is in the Chaba'as, the group of 1,000, concerning which Blackman comments, the Chaba'as must mean 1,000 is her souls and refer to the countless stars appearing by night on the body of Nut. We've got our ship still. Well, we should have our ship back again. Did Abraham count the stars too? Well, of course he did. He was asked not only to count the stars as a metaphorical measure of his progeny in Genesis 15:5, but as an observer. He's told to habet, to observe them, and sefor, to count them. Also, we see him, according to facsimile number 3, reasoning on principles of astronomy in the king's court, and the Egyptian word for reasoning is the same as count. Reasoning and counting are the same word in the famous funeral stela of a great princess, the daughter of Psammeticus II, came right after Lehi's time, which reads, "Behold, ye Khabasu of Heliopolis, the god is born, the one who takes the helm of thousands. Osiris, and Kesniferimbre, that's the girl's name, she was a great princess, and she pushed somebody else out of office, will calculate the seasons with you concerning the secret of the great hall of the gods, and will take you along, and will take along Osiris in his ship of 1,000, even with the 2 heads, the heads that either end, so that by it he can mount to heaven and to the counter heaven." Well, the third most significant thing about figure 4, according to Smith, is its office in measuring time. Since all these figures mark both the completion and initiation of various life cycles, there is the essence of this figure, the Sokar ship, the most important coordinating of all time. Well, we've only done 4 figures. There's a marvelous section in the next figure. Well, we'll have something on this tonight, but there are some other things that should be mentioned that have never been mentioned here that should be called your attention. So we have 2 more times to do it, if anybody bothered to come by. Again, I'm sorry to have confused you as badly I could have confused myself, but it all hangs together if you just think about it and go home and study these things. Thank you very much.